This is such a great time to be a gardener. Hope springs eternal when we put those first seeds in the ground or see those perennials and bulbs popping up. Last year's drought, though, really damaged many lawns and gardens, and a lot of us wondering what we can do now to revitalize those gardens. Larry Mueller here. Welcome to Garden Talk. We're lucky to have such a great roster of gardening experts who spend time with us on Garden Talk, and we know that one of your favorites is Melinda Myers. She is Milwaukee-based garden expert, author of more than 20 books, and host of Melinda's Garden Moments, and we love it when she joins us. Melinda, always a pleasure.
Hey, it's always great to be here, and at least we can talk gardening, even though it may not be the best day.
Not the best day. Oh, I'm telling you. I'm sure we're going to get into the poor gardeners in northern Wisconsin in a minute, but let's talk about something really pleasant. You just got back from a garden trip to Paris.
I did. I hosted, and a few of your listeners joined me. We had a wonderful time. Spring was a little late there, but there were bulbs blooming. The grass was green, and I had a chance to visit Monet's garden, Giverny. And, oh, you know, I've been a big fan of his artwork, but to see his test gardens where he put plants together and used such great colors to make them work, it really inspired all of us on the trip. And I have to tell you a funny story. We're walking into the garden. There were some garlic mustard popping up. It's native in Europe, but, you know, where it wasn't wanted. And I had to go, don't touch that. We're not allowed to weed here because, you know, gardener's first reaction, we got to get rid of that garlic mustard. Only a few plants the gardeners had not reached yet, so I'm sure it's taken care of by now. But it was amazing. And in Paris, tons of rooftop gardens. You know, people squeezing containers in every little space. You know, it's such a vibrant city and a lot of concrete and old buildings. But, boy, they have beautiful park systems and real inspiration for those of us gardening, whether it's a small space or a large space, to make the most of every square inch you have.
And then you come back to Wisconsin. And, you know, the people in northern Wisconsin, I mean, wouldn't about now you be really, really sick of snow and then to get it right now? And frankly, I heard that lots of trees and shrubs were damaged by the wet, heavy snow.
Yeah, you know, some of us may remember the May 10th snowstorm that hit a lot of southern Wisconsin, and our spring was a little earlier, and the leaves were out in full force, and that weight on those big leaves just really ripped things apart. I'm sure the heavy snow is causing damage. The only plus is this cool spring has slowed things down, so it could have been worse. It's easy for me to say as I'm looking at rain and not shoveling snow, but you're right. So the main thing is to wait till, you know, the storm passes, get a certified arborist out there. If you have big trees, you don't want to climb up there. Get someone who has the equipment to do the job correctly and safely and do corrective pruning. The other thing, this is a good opportunity. You know, gardeners, I think, are optimistic, though they may not be feeling that way today, is, you know, this is a chance to say, okay, maybe I do need to do some structural pruning, get an arborist in there to really take care of crossed, broken, damaged branches, you know, any narrow crotch angles that are more subject to wind and snow and heavy rains and storm damage. Because if we do some pruning proactively, we can reduce the damage. Can't eliminate it all because nature's going to have the last word, but we can get our trees in better shape and proper pruning on our shrubs. We can help reduce some of those problems. You know, when we have these fluke storms and high winds and rains and snow loads. So, you know, kind of wait. Don't get out there and start knocking things off the trees. You know, you can sometimes do more damage when you start shaking branches than letting that snow recede on its own.
Sue in River Falls has a related question, I believe. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Thank you.
Hey, Sue.
Got all these flowers and plants already, and like too many, and they're in my garage right now because of the snow. And what's the best way to keep them healthy until the ground soil is appropriate? And what is the correct temperature when I can plant them for the ground?
Okay, great question. And with the wet weather, not in the cool temperatures, you're right, Sue. We have to watch not only the air temperature warm up, but the sun on the soil as well. So a couple things. Those plants, I'm guessing, came out of a greenhouse if they're up and growing, so they're going to need sunlight. I met a great gardener. She's been gardening for many, many years in her 80s or 90s, and what she does is she has an old truck, loads up all her plants, and on nice days she drives it out so they get sunlight and then partially shade, then a little more sun the next day, and then on cold nights she drives it back into her garage and just continues. And I thought, wow, this is a creative gardener. Now, you may not have room, I never did in my garage, for an extra vehicle just for my plants, but, you know, wagons and things like that that allow you to move it out and in, covering it with floating row covers can protect your plants down to 24 degrees. So that's another way to provide a little shade if you do a couple layers and protect them from frost. You may want to move them into a sheltered area once that snow recedes, cover them up, and then warm the soil to get them out and planted. Prep the soil when it's moist, not too wet. Cover it with clear plastic for a week or two to warm it up. Pop the plants in and provide some row cover. Some plants like pansies can take it cool and snapdragons in stock, and others like geraniums and petunias and tomatoes and peppers, you need to wait until things warm. But I'm guessing you've either got perennials or some annuals. But if they've been up and growing in the greenhouse, they're going to need some frost protection and a little warmer soils just to make that adjustment a little easier.
There you go.
Like right now, looking outside on the temperature, it's only like 35.
Yeah. Right.
I don't care. Do you have on sleds and on wire racks right now, and I've been putting them in and out when it was decent.
Excellent.
But I shouldn't put them out today if it's only 34, right?
Right, without protection, exactly. And what kind of plants do you have?
Oh, I have, like, the hanging pots, and I have herbs, and I have perennials, and I have annuals. And I had them out on the sunny days with the row cover over them on my sleds.
Yeah.
And but with all this snow, it's lucky I took them in.
Yeah.
Yeah, and exactly. And the row covers will protect your plants down to 24 degrees. But again, going from, I'm guessing, depending on the types of annuals and where the perennials were grown before, you know, if they were in a greenhouse, you know, going from that to 36, even with row covers, is tough. So once the snow is gone, and you're right, good planning on your part, you know, pop them out with the row covers. As they get used to it, they'll be able to take those cooler temperatures, but it will stunt them. So if you can keep them in and out, if they're fully leafed out, once they're hardened off a couple of weeks from now, they'll take the temperatures in the 30s if they're cool season annuals like pansies. But if they like the warmer temperatures, you're going to have to wait until the danger of frost has passed and the soils are much warmer, you know, in the high 50s and low 60s to put those warm season annuals out.
I have the fluorescent lights on in the garage and some fans blowing. Does that help?
Oh, you bet. And the fluorescent lights being, you know, within a foot of the top of the plants or as close as you can get them, I'm sure you've got different heights and sizes, that's definitely going to help.
Good luck. Thank you very much, Sue, for calling. Appreciate it. Melinda Meyer is our guest today, Milwaukee-based garden expert, the author of more than 20 gardening books, talking with her today, obviously, about the gardens and revitalizing our gardens for this year. You can join in with your own questions at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Of course, we'd love to hear from you. What drought damage are you seeing in your yard or garden, and how do you plan to address it? Love to hear from you. And Melinda, of course, is always happy to help. What are some, you know, we've got some thin lawns, damaged lawns out there, bare spots, large bare spots, small ones. What about repairing on lawns?
You know, all this rain has delayed the spring. The cooler temperatures is great for a lot of our grass, but slowed up a lot of greening. Things just seem to be taking off now, so it's a good time to assess. If you did some dormant seeding, that grass, I did some dormant seeding last fall. Mine's just starting to peek through. The soil's just starting to warm up. If you've got bare spots or thin lawns, this is, you know, early May usually is a good time, but I think with this cooler weather and all the rain, we're going to be going into mid-May. We just basically want to get the grass seed down and up and growing before the heat of summer. When it does get hot this year, it will. So, you know, you could do small patches. I like to take a handful of grass seed, mix it with a bucket of topsoil to make a lawn patch kit, scratch up those bare areas, sprinkle that mix, and moisten. Now, the key is water. If it continues to rain, no problem. But if we have a dry spell and you seed it, you're going to need to get out there and water. Thin lawns, or maybe if you've got lots of patches and you don't want patches of dark green grass that's a different shade of green than the rest of your lawn, you might want to overseed, you know, either core aerate the lawn. Dethatching's hard on the lawn. It'll get rid of the thatch and expose the soil, but it's pretty tough on our already stressed lawn. So I like to core aerate and then overseed, spread grass seed with like a fertilizer spreader. That way you open up that soil so you get good seed-to-soil contact, and that increases your chance of success with overseeding. And then your grass acts as a living mulch, so you get that double benefit, and you're spreading that new grass seed throughout the lawn to help it blend a little better.
Nick in Green Bay has a question. Hi, Nick. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for having the show. Two questions, actually. I only asked one as a screener, but two questions, actually. I'd like to put a garden in my backyard. And my backyard has got a creek in there, and right now with the rainy season like this, it's not a creek, it's a raging river.
Yep.
So I was wondering if you could actually put a garden in there, plus I got deer and everything else back there. And the other option I would like to think about is, like, doing some beds to plant some vegetables or something, but what is your suggestion for something like that? Because it's really wet back there. Like, I can go in the middle of summer and dig down 3 inches and hit water.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
What you may want to do is look at some native wetland plants that, you know, things like marsh marigold that will take the damp soils, especially in the spring, and bright yellow flowers and glossy green leaves, skunk cabbage, you know, some of those wetland plants that are native that you might want to put those in areas where you've got flooding. Then out further from the creek, you may consider doing a raised bed to get the plants up above that wet, that high water table, or use containers. There aren't a lot of vegetables that are going to take that much moisture and do... And so, you know, doing the raised bed or containers might be a way, and as far away from that creek as possible will be a great way, I think, just to elevate the plants above that and then using some of your native wetland plants. I know the University of Minnesota has a great publication on restoration of streams and riverbanks, and they talk about a lot of native plants. I haven't seen anything from Wisconsin, but you might want to check on their learning store in case I've missed something. But looking for some of those wetland native plants is a good way to take advantage of that situation rather than fighting nature.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks, Nick.
Okay,
thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Guy and Kimberly, hello to you.
Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Hi. I was just listening, and I just wanted to know a foolproof way to have the most green lawn in the spring that anyone has ever seen.
Okay. What do we got?
You feed the rabbits all winter long. We spread corn cobs out all over 2 years in a row, and the next summer you had to cut it twice a week.
So a little natural fertilizer application and spreader. And hopefully your neighbors are appreciating that you're bringing the rabbits into your yard and not there. So it might be a really good win for the whole neighborhood.
Oh, man, good point. Thank you, Guy. Appreciate your call. You're listening to Garden Talk here. Larry Mueller with my guest Melinda Meyer, Milwaukee-based garden expert, author of more than 20 books, Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller with my guest, Melinda Myers. You know, many people who are gardeners, and I think probably most people who are gardeners, are also birders and love birding. And I just wanted to mention that Judith and I are teaming up with the Natural Resources Foundation to do a birding trip at Picnic Point in Madison.
That's an excellent idea.
Yeah.
You're right. Gardeners and birders go hand in hand. It's a great hobby, and especially in the winter when there's not a lot of plant life, it's great to see some color and motion with those birds coming into the landscape.
Yeah, and it's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to be going, Judith and I will be going, and Andy Paulios, will kind of lead our outing. He's the coordinator of the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative, and he's a biologist with the Wisconsin DNR. It's going to be at Picnic Point in Madison on Sunday, May 12th from 8:30 to 11:30, and we have room for 20 people to join us. So we'll be picking 10 listeners, and each listener can bring a guest, so we'll have 20 people. And I'm just going to tell people to enter, send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org, and put Bird Trip as the subject. And you send that email by 5 on Sunday evening, and we'll let people know on Monday if they've won, and they'll need to confirm by Tuesday morning to secure their spot. So be sure you're checking your emails. That's for, again, May 12th from 8:30 to 11:30 at Picnic Point in Madison. I've spent many days out on Picnic Point, and the birding out there is fantastic.
And what a great present for Mom.
Yeah,
it's Mom out to go birding with you and Judith. What a fun thing that would be, and then go out to brunch later.
That sounds like a plan to me. So, again, to enter, send an email to talk@wpr.org, and then put Bird Trip in the subject. And I think Judith also, I'm sure Judith also has something up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and you can go there to learn some more about it. But looking forward to it, I hope you come. I hope you apply. Do that. In the meantime, you may have a question for our guest today, Melinda Myers. And in fact, Marlene in Laval has one. So let's go to her. Hi, Marlene.
Hi. Love your show.
Thank you.
I have two perennial hibiscus, and I'm wondering if I can cut off the old growth, or do they grow from the old growth?
You can cut off the old growth. The one thing, though, you might want to leave some of the stem standing because they are late to emerge. And so sometimes, or put a stake by them, or gardeners will sometimes plant spring bulbs by their perennial hibiscus so that they don't accidentally dig them up when they see those, you know, dead stems. So yes, you can cut them back. Just be aware that if it's going to be slow, and especially this cool spring, they're really going to be slow coming out. But right. Yes, no problem pruning them back. Just mark the spot so you don't accidentally cultivate them out.
Thank you so much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Judy in Madison, hi to you.
Hello. I heard the answer to my question possibly from another caller about rabbits, and I'm having a horrible time with them in my yard, but I don't think I can go to my neighbors and spread things in their yard to throw them out. So I'll just try, like, using some chicken wire to get the rabbits out of some of my plants that are just coming up. But they seem to be digging under it. And a neighbor suggested mothballs, which are kind of toxic and I don't want to use. I've tried a few sprays, but every time it rains, I have to go back out. I'm wondering if you have any really good suggestions for rabbits that are eating your garden away.
Yeah, good question, and your neighbors will appreciate that you're not spreading corn.
Yeah,
on their
for
yard.
Sure.
You're right. Hardware cloth is even better than chicken wire, being a little smaller and stiffer, and then sinking it a couple inches in the soil sometimes will discourage them. Populations are high. There's enough food. They are going to do some digging. At least 4 feet tall. You might want to try scare tactics, depending on, you know. My home was in the city, and so there's nothing I could do to scare those urban rabbits. Repellents, as you mentioned, you have to reapply. Some stick a little better, and you want to make sure that there are some natural products. Messina Animal Stopper is made of herbs. It smells good, so it doesn't repel us, which a lot of those animal repellents work on people just as well as animals. But you do want to try to get them before they start feeding whatever repellent you use and repeat as directed. Some, like this one, Messina Animal Stopper, have a sticker so they hold up better in the rain. Though this spring, I think anything's going to need replacement. So kind of a combination. I'm with you on mothballs. Funny story, George Harrison, who does the bird part of Birds in Bloom with me, I had a question one time from a gardener who said they put out mothballs to keep the squirrels away, and they found the squirrels playing with the mothballs. Huh. I called George, and yeah, I know, and I said, so George, is this for real? And he goes, oh, yeah. The mothballs help the animals. It helps take care of the lice, the body lice on the animals. So he said, you'll often find them rolling on those mothballs. So I'm with you. You know, they're toxic things. I'm not sure I want them out there for kids and wildlife and things, and actually we might be helping the wildlife. So you might want to try some natural repellent scare tactics. There is a mini scarecrow that uses compressed air and noise. Again, you may want to get your neighbors to buy in, because the idea is the animal hops in front of it. It gets hit with compressed air. First, this noise goes off, a really loud siren-y noise goes off, and then it's hit with, compressed air. The idea is that eventually it gets the compressed air, and then it knows a noise is coming, and so you can turn off the noisemaker eventually, and then the animal will just be scared away by the compressed air. You just have to make sure your neighbors buy into this, and you can stand it as well. So it's kind of that combination of things, and then seeing what's working. Some people have luck with cayenne pepper, sprinkling it on their plants as maybe a more natural product as well.
Mm-hmm. So give those things a try, Judy, and thank you very much for calling. We have an email from Ken in Marshfield. That is a nice compliment coming for you here, Mel. Ken says, I noted a couple of weeks ago that Melinda has produced a recent DVD for the Great Courses. It's entitled How to Grow Anything, Your Best Garden and Landscape in 6 Lessons. I have it, watched it, and highly recommend it. So what do you think of that?
Thank you so much. Well, thank you. It just came out in April, and it was a great project. I designed and help plant and manage and deal with gardens in Washington, D.C. area. So that was challenging. But we redid a small space and a large space garden. And the fun part was you got to travel with me as we made out the plan, then adjusted the plan based on what was available, then readjusted the plan based on and so it was a real-life garden video. So it wasn't the, okay, we're starting out today and it's done in 3 hours. It was more realistic. And so we get to do some really fun things. And there's the How to Grow Anything for a Beautiful Landscape. And then there's one on container gardens as well. And that was really a lot of fun that we used it in small space, containers in small space, large space, and a variety of settings. So
that's really cool. Where do you get that?
Thank you, Ken. You can go to Great Courses. We'll have a link up on our website next week. But if you check out my website, melindamyers.com, next week we'll have a banner ad, or just Google Great Courses. And they're known for their liberal arts studies, and so this is their first horticulture endeavor, and I got to join them on that.
That's
so it was a lot of fun.
Very, very cool. Well, Darlene in Green Bay has a question for you. So, Darlene, are you there?
I am.
Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have many daffodils in my yard, and I have a couple of bunches that usually have like, maybe 200 daffodils on it. Now, this year, some of the daffodils that have come up are much shorter, but I have a lot of my bunches of daffodils with no flowers, and so I'm questioning about that.
Good question. And here's the deal with daffodils. The early blooming daffodils are often damaged by cold temperatures. So, you know, when they come up in the spring, the flower buds look very much like leaves. They're very flat until they start to swell. At that stage, they're real sensitive to cold temperatures. So if your daffodils popped up and started blooming, and then we got one of our many cold snaps this spring, it could have knocked out the flower buds. And that's, you know, when they're just in that stage, you don't notice the blooms. A lot of people are just starting to get their daffodils popping up, depending on the microclimates in your yard. If it's just a problem this year, I think wait another year and see what happens based on the weather. If this is a continual problem, it may be time to dig and divide daffodils, you know, if they've overgrown and they're really crowded. If they're getting a lot more shade than when you planted, you know, they are shade tolerant, but there's a certain point where they won't tolerate the shade. But if they're early bloomers, it might be just some cold weather damage.
Okay, so I should give them another year.
I would, if they were fine last year, I would give them another year and wait and see. It won't hurt to dig them and divide them if you're feeling antsy, but, you know, I think it could be a response to the weather. I used to have daffodils in my backyard right up against my neighbor's house in the city, and they were early bloomers, and I probably got flowers 3 out of 5 years because they were early. They would sprout early because they were by her house, and we'd get a cold snap, and I'd lose the bloom. So I knew it was a risk, but boy, those 3 years or 2 years they bloomed every five was well worth not getting flowers the
other. That's right. That's right. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. My wife's favorite flowers, the daffodils.
Oh, and how can you not smile when you see them?
Absolutely.
And, you know, and I just want to put a plug in. I'm going to be at Berner Botanical Gardens, again, doing our series.
Mm-hmm.
This year's is Garden Revitalization. And if you've joined me in the past, you know the garden always looks different every May when we go out there. So this year, I think we're going to have blooms. Last year, they were all done, the bulbs. And I think what's fun is we get to see that garden and relate it to ours. And all the proceeds go to the Children's Education Program. So I joined forces with the Friends of Berner to kind of share the beauty of the gardens and support children's garden education programs as well.
That is very, very cool. We have Ruth in Wauwatosa with a question for you. Hi, Ruth.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Hi.
I would like to grow sunflowers that both for their beauty and for seeds for the birds. I picked up some seeds, and when I got at home, I noticed they were pollenless. Will they produce a seed or not?
The pollen is for pollinating others. Do you remember the variety? Chances are you don't need the male part to form seed, but you do need the female parts. And a lot of the pollenless ones, you won't get the cross-pollination, and so you won't get the fruit. And those are often the doubles and some of the new varieties that are used for cutting. But do you remember the varieties?
These are the newer varieties for cutting. One was called Chianti. I can't remember one. But I wanted multi-branching ones, and I wanted the smaller flowered ones. I have some 14-inch tall ones that I grow on my deck, and the finches come and eat right off of my deck, and they are so cute.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Looking for something that produced smaller seed heads that I could collect and then bring out in the wintertime.
Yeah, and that's, and a lot of those pollenless ones are, they'll produce some seed, but mostly not. So you'll get lots of blooms, you'll get double flowers, they're great for bouquets, and usually, they do produce. So the others that produce pollen are usually get seeds. So you do have some things like Teddy that's a little smaller, and you'll still get some seeds off of those. So, yeah, you'll want to look for those that on the pictures have the nice dark gray flowers and show and talk about producing seeds. So pollenless ones mean you won't have the pollen on your table when you have cut flowers, but not going to give you the abundance that you're looking for in terms of food for the birds.
There you go, Ruth.
Find, too, Ruth, is a lot of times your sunflowers will reseed, come up at different heights, which may not be good for you, but often are multi-headed at that point as well. So you get the multiple heads on those.
Okay.
Would they maybe produce seed if I had another variety that did produce pollen?
Yeah, at the same time, right. So that would be the key. So if you had, you know, depends on how much, usually not as much. So you're looking for some of the pollenless ones, like, you know, that you've got. So, yeah. So
could work, but you might want to just start over again.
Exactly. Maybe mix them in there so you have some for cutting and some for the birds. That might be a fun solution.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Thanks, Ruth, for calling. And Ray in Winter, Wisconsin. Hello. All right, well, let's see. Let's get him on here. There, now we've got him. Hi, Ray.
Hi. Hi, Larry. Love your show. I'm actually in the truck going up to Winter. We have a cabin up there, and I'm working up there this weekend. Unfortunately, my master gardener wife is not with me, but I picked up at St. Croix County a 60 bare root maples, and what do I do with them?
You got snow there, haven't you?
Yeah, we got about 14 inches of snow up there.
My wife said maybe go ahead.
It temporarily, but you know, I'm stymied. You know, I don't have the green thumb.
And so she left you with the 60 bare root maples to deal with. If you've got an area that's sheltered and protected and the plants are dormant, you may want to shovel the snow away, dig a trench in a vacant garden spot, and then just heal those in until you can deal with them. The other option is to store them in a cool but frost-free location. So if you have a garage or someplace that they won't freeze, and then wrap the roots in damp peat moss or sawdust and newspaper to keep them from drying out. I don't know how long you have between your next visit, or you're going to be up there and be able to plant after the snow melts, or are you going to be back soon or staying up there for a while?
We'd be back in about 2 weeks.
Yeah, you're going to want to make sure you've got them in a cool spot, and if you can get them in the ground, that's going to be the easiest thing. Just heal them in, dig a trench. Don't worry about spacing, because you're going to come back and move them out, but that'll give you the best results, because if it gets warm, I'm afraid your garage, you know, it's Wisconsin, who knows? You know, I'm afraid it'll get too hot and it'll dry out. So if you can heal them in, that's going to be your best bet. So you're going to have to shovel snow first, then dig a trench next, so... But it'll pay off
good luck. Oh man, I'd heal him in for sure. Nancy and Grafton, thank you for calling. Hi.
Well, hello. I've got a flower bed, and in there's lots of tulips and daffodils and, you know, other perennials. But there's some kind of a gosh darn flower thing that grows up about, oh heck, a couple feet high, and it gets like little bluebells on it. There is invasive. I can't get rid of them. And if you dig down, you got to go down quite a bit, and it's like a internet underneath the ground. Those roots just go all over. How in the heck can I get rid of those things?
Yeah, it's a creeping bellflower that is aggressive, and it's awful to get rid of. It's beautiful in flower, but like you said, it just forms a mat of rhizomes and roots, and it takes over. You may choose to lift your bulbs and pot them up and get them out of the garden, and then treat that bed and anything else you want to save, and treat that bed with a total vegetation killer. And you're going to have to do several applications. And your garden probably, you may not be able to replant till late summer or fall, because you're going to want to knock it down, then wait and see what grows, hit it again, then see what grows and hit it again. And by the other option, if you don't want to use chemicals, is to edge that bed, cover it with clear plastic. You're going to basically cook the soil surface and below to kill out those rhizomes. First, it's going to act like a greenhouse, and those plants are going to grow and flourish, and then they're going to cook and die. But Kansas State found that 6 to 8 weeks covering with clear plastic can solarize, kill a lot of your weed seeds and some of your disease problems. And that would also work. But you may want to do, if you don't mind chemicals, Roundup, hit it, wait a few weeks. If they start growing, hit it again. Make sure you've got it out of there. Make sure any plants you save, that none of the rhizomes are in there, because you'd hate to replant it with your good plants back into the garden you finally rid of that.
I was kind of thinking if a person could go and put on a rubber glove and then put cotton over that and put your hand in there and touch all the tops of them, would that help?
You know what? I hear that recommendation, and I never, ever like to say to anybody to stick your hand in pesticide. Instead, if you want to leave your plants intact, it's going to be a little more difficult because of the intensity, but you can use something a gardener introduced me to. He calls the tongs of death. And he takes sponges, puts them on the end of tongs. You know, you could use the large barbecue type, only for your garden, of course. Mm-hmm. Dips those into the Roundup and then wipes that on the plant. So your hands are out of it. I mean, you know, I just put in your hands, even if you've got a rubber glove, what if there's a hole in there, you know?
Yeah.
So just that's one way of wiping it on the plants. You just want to make sure you don't touch your good plants. The other option is to cover your good plants with a milk jug if you've got more of the weed than the good stuff, and then treat the bad plants, or vice versa. Cover the weeds with a milk jug, bottom removed, spray the Roundup, let it drip down. Once it hits the soil, it's not going to affect your good plants. It's just if the Roundup hits the leaves of your good plants, that's where you end up with problems.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's probably going to take you a while, but it'll be worth the effort if you keep after it.
And thanks again, Nancy, for calling. And we have some open lines, so we can get you on pretty quickly with your gardening question at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us as well at talk@WPR.org. or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. I'm Larry Mehler. Melinda Myers, our Milwaukee-based gardening expert, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking everything in the garden today with Melinda Myers, our Milwaukee-based garden expert, author of more than 20 books. I hope you'll go to her Facebook page. Her link is melindamyers.com. And just to remind you, Myers is spelled M-Y-E-R-S, melindamyers.com, M-Y-E-R-S. Great to have her along. Thank you for listening in. We had an email from Mary, who's had, this has to do with repelling rabbits. She's had some good luck repelling rabbits with Milorganite. Double benefit is that it also fertilizes plants. However, as with most animal deterrents, you need to switch it out over time with other methods, sort of back and forth, like hardware cloth or chicken wire cages, that sort of thing.
Great, thank you. Yes, they've done some research and found that it is very effective. It's not labeled for that, so you're fertilizing your plants, you get that extra benefit.
There you go. Carol and Toma, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I've got a question. I have someone donating to me a lot of daffodil bulbs, and I want to know, after they're done blossoming, when can I dig them?
You know, daffodils are pretty tough. I have dug them in bloom, not the most desirable time, because I've had to move them. You know, if you can wait 6 to 8 weeks so they have a good opportunity to put energy back in, that's great. The leaves will still be green. As you know, with daffodils, they last forever. But if you can give them a good 6 weeks, that'll maximize the energy in case you break off leaves and that type of thing. But if you can take them intact and the leaves intact, you can move them almost any time.
So if I dig them after they're done blossoming, should I just leave the leaves on them until I'm ready to plant them in the fall?
Well, you could plant them right away. So, you know, you could dig them and move them. Do you have the place ready for them, or you don't have a new planting spot?
I do not, no.
Yeah, so then give them at least 6 to 8 weeks then, if you can, in their old spot. And then if you need to store them, if you have to move them because the owner wants them out of there before you're ready to put them in the garden, then you want to store them in a cool place. You can remove the leaves at that point. After at least 6 to 8 weeks after bloom, they'll put the energy back in. You should get enough so that you have bloom next year. Then let them dry out. Store them in a cool, dark place. A spare refrigerator would work fine. Check to make sure they're not rotting, and then plant them when you can in the fall when we'd normally plant bulbs. Otherwise, if you had a space available, you could just move them from one spot to the other. So anyone else that's in that position that maybe has the space to plant them right away, they could just dig them, move them. So you're going to have to do that extra step.
And what about tulips?
Hybrid tulips don't always continue to bloom year after year. They'll produce leaves and often decline. So you want to make sure they're good blooming tulips before you put the effort in. Those, for sure, 6 to 8 weeks, they're going to die back at that point. So they'll be a lot easier to manage. As those leaves yellow and brown, pop those out and move them. And again, store them in a cool, dark place.
There you go.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks, Carol.
Okay, good luck. Sounds like you'll be busy.
Yes. Bob in Oak Park, Illinois. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I've got a couple questions about clematis plants. I've got one, the fall blooming variety with the little white flowers that smell good. Don't know what the variety is, but it grows like a weed. And one of the questions is how best to prune it, because I cut it back as best I can, but I really don't have a rhyme or reason to it, and it always seems to grow like crazy.
Yeah, Sweet Autumn Clematis, one of my favorites, and you're right, they are very robust. And I had one in my old house, my small city lot, that really covered the fence, and it went from sun to pretty heavy shade. And if I didn't prune it back, it really took over. So cutting it back, if you haven't done it, now's a great time. You can cut it back to about 12 inches above the ground, cut all the stems, and it will pop back and grow and fill out from top to bottom. We prune clematis really to control the size or to remove dead or damaged stems. And like you said, Sweet Autumn Clematis is a vigorous grower. So once established, yearly pruning helps to keep it under control.
Okay, and also, what I've got some room on the same, it faces east against the garage, and it seems to like that location. I was thinking about placing another one, maybe 8 feet away or so, but would like a summer blooming variety, and wanted to see if you had any recommendations.
As long as you can keep that one out of the way, that would be good. There is a new, and I don't know if it's going to be available or all sold out, Proven Winners has a new summer blooming, purple-flowered sweet autumn clematis that blooms in the summer. And I'm trying to remember the name. It's brand new, and I was going to order it myself because it was really a cool plant, and it's brand new this year. I'm kind of stalling here as I'm looking up the name, but it's a summer bloomer, same fragrance, but purple flowers, so it's a little bit earlier. And that might be a fun one to try as well. If you want something a little less rigorous, I love Betty Corning. It's a blue-flowering, bell-shaped, not as vigorous. It's vigorous, but it's not as robust and won't overtake things like the Sweet Autumn does. But mine blooms for like 3 months, and it's beautiful blue bell-shaped flowers that are just excellent.
Oh,
so you might want to try that one as well. And so that's another good one. Of course, Nellie Mosier has the purple and the lavender striped flowers. Jackman is a favorite summer bloomer. There's some others, and I'm pulling up my notes on this cool cool clematis. So I am trying to kill some time here.
Yeah.
So thanks for your patience as I'm trying to pull the name that I can't think of, but it's a beautiful plant, and it's maybe hard to find this year. It's out of Proven Winners or Spring Meadow Nursery, actually. And
okay, I will look it up. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you. I wasn't fast enough. So, yeah, check it out. It's a really cool plant, and I think if it's not available this year, you'll see it. It's called Sweet Summer Love Clematis. Sweet Summer Love Clematis. So purple flowers, nice fragrance, blooms in the summer.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, Josh and Racine had a clematis question, too, is wondering how much and how often to add lime to the soil around his clematis. He's in Racine.
Yeah.
It always dies out about halfway through the year. I'm unsure of the type, but it does have purple flowers.
Well, I'm glad he brought this up. In Racine, you do not need to add lime. Clematis like sweeter alkaline soil, and you have plenty of that in Racine, just like I do here. It's southeastern Wisconsin, southern Wisconsin. Our soils are sweet or have a high pH, so we do not need to add lime. So don't add lime. That's for those growing in central northern Wisconsin with more acidic soil. What may be happening is you may have stem wilt, and that's a common fungal disease, and you can prune out those stems if they turn black to brown. They die from a canker, prune them out at ground level, get rid of them. I found that proper sanitation, so if in the fall you cut it right back to the ground, if it's affected by this disease, that with weather cooperating and good cleanup and minimize your damage, try to handle it carefully so you don't damage those stems as they're growing in spring when you're tying them to their support, usually you can keep it under control. A copper fungicide will help reduce the issue, but usually sanitation is enough. So forget the lime. Do good cleanup. If you can remove the stems that are diseased when you find them, I just find it such a tangled mess, it's hard to do. So in the fall, right to the ground level if you have stem wilt, and then just manage the plant carefully to avoid injury, and that's usually enough to take care of it.
Jack in Milwaukee has a question. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Melinda, I was wondering if I can still divide my hostas if they haven't sprouted yet.
No, you can divide them after they sprout, too, for that matter.
Right, exactly. hostas are pretty tough, so, you know, usually the benefit is as they're coming up and peeking through the ground, they're a lot easier to manage, and see, and you can see them then as to opposed to before they start to grow. I have some that I would handle much more delicately than others just because I spent way too much money on them for no other reason. But I've dug and divided, and it sounds like you have two, Larry, any time of the year. As long as you give them good post-transplant care, they'll be great. So, you know, I haven't even thought about getting out to dig and divide because it's so been so wet out there. So you've got plenty of time to do it before they start growing or even afterwards, too. As long as you make sure they receive sufficient moisture, you've prepared the ground ahead of time, they'll be great. You'll have no problem.
Will they grow in clay?
They, you know, yes, if you can add some organic matter and amend the soil, they're pretty tough and tolerant plants. I have seen them grow in some pretty lousy soil conditions. I used to teach in Mequon, and boy, it was heavy clay soil up there, and they survived.
Okay.
So
right.
Investing a little organic matter would be a great way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thank you.
Yep, thanks for calling.
Okay, good luck. Tough plants, good choice, so
they'll
do great.
Email from Mark. We recently moved here from a city where brewed compost tea was available at local nurseries. I can't find a place near Appleton where they sell it. I would like to use it again on my lawn and garden beds because I've always seen the difference it makes. Any ideas where to get it?
You know, there are a couple of lawn care companies that are using that product. There's an organization called MELA, Midwest Ecological Landscape Association, I think it is. They're based out of Chicago, but their members, that might be a place to try to find a member. The folks at Purple Cow Organics, I think they're White Oak Farms, Purple Cow Organics, I can't remember which name they're using now, they have worked with some lawn care people who are doing some compost brewing as well. You might want to get online. I don't know anyone offhand that I could tell you, but if you are patient with me and nudge me, if you email me at info@melindamyers.com, I'll see if I can find somebody in your area to help you.
Thanks again for that question. And Mike in Portage, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Calling with solutions instead of questions.
Okay.
Oh, great.
A couple of things. First, the lady who had all the stuff growing in between the plants she wanted, one of the ways I apply Roundup is I use a can, cut out the bottom, or even a paper towel tube, and I feed either the one I want to protect or the one that I want to kill into the tube, and either spray outside the tube or inside the tube. And so, you know, I can get rid of quackgrass out of my strawberries or crabgrass. I don't know which one it is.
Right.
Anyway.
And the milk jug works great, as I mentioned, for bigger weeds or bigger plants and a soda bottle, too. So great idea.
Yeah. And so you don't even have to, you know, it's pretty easy. Just find a can, cut out the bottom, and there you go. The can. The fence, the rabbit fence, chicken wire, the rabbits dig under it. I have a chicken yard and had to keep raccoons out. And so what I did was I put chicken wire along the bottom, and I make a little L so that it comes about 6 inches toward the outside and then starts up the fence. And what happens is that the critters go into that corner and try to dig right up against the fence, but their chicken wire's there. And so it keeps them from digging in. If they would back up 6 inches and start digging, they could get under it.
But they never do that.
And then I hold it down with a wire. I use old fence wire, but you could use something like old hangers and make little U's or V's and pin it down so that you can mow over it and the grass can grow up through the chicken wire and you can mow right up against the fence without sucking the wire into the blade. So I kind of staple the chicken wire down until the grass can grow into it, and it keeps 6 inches, and I don't have to bury the stuff, and it keeps critters from digging into it.
Excellent. Well, thank you for sharing that. That's one of the things I love about gardeners is they share plants and they share ideas. So thanks, Mike. That's great.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Jerry in Menominee, hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. I have a problem. My house is for sale. And, of course, I was hoping to be able to take some flowers with me, but I don't have a house yet to purchase. Okay? And I have a wildflower garden that has a couple different varieties of lady slippers and hepatica and all these things. And I'm wondering if I can dig them with enough soil around them, if I could keep them in pots and water them and take care of them like they would be in the ground.
What do you think, Melinda?
Yeah, wildflowers are always challenging, even to direct plant, but especially if you don't think the person who buys your house is going to care for them, it's probably worth a try. And you're right, you want to take as much of that soil as you can and then mark the pot because, as you know, a lot of our wildflowers are ephemerals and die back, so you want to make sure that when someone's helping you move all those containers, they don't throw it in the compost pile thinking it died. So you want to make sure to label them. I recently moved, and I dug a lot of my plants and popped them. I left my few wildflowers intact because I was worried I didn't have a good spot to put them and that I thought they'd a better chance staying there. But I think it would be a lady slipper. Oh, I'd take the chance to move them. So, yeah, as much as you can, good soil because you want that nice organic rich soil. Label them so you know that they're there when they go dormant and keep them in a shaded location so you can get them in their new home.
Makes good sense. Melinda Myers, our guest today, Milwaukee-based garden expert and author of more than 20 books on gardening. It's always so great to have her with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, it's springtime, if you can believe it, here in Wisconsin. Time for a little planting for gardeners and farmers alike. Larry Mueller here with this edition of Garden Talk. Our guest today, Melinda Myers, Milwaukee-based garden expert and author of more than 20 books on gardening. It's great to have her along. I also have a little feature today from writer and farmer Justin Isherwood. It seems like a good spot to bring this in. He shares his reflections on the ancient art and annual practice of planting.
Planting? I mean, spring planting is the oldest part of us. There are other items of the same vintage. You know the list. Fire, the spear, the arrow, followed by remorse, I suppose. But before the village, before the wall, before the tower, before the market square, before language, before wine, was planting. Jericho, it is said, may be the world's first village. 17,000, maybe 20,000 years previous. The rise of that village, of any village, marks the spot where began our kinship with the invention we call the field. First came barley, to be followed soon after by bread, beer, and bowling, and with that the rest of the human expedition was underway, all of it from Greece and China, from most ancient Babylon. The wars, the heroes, the face of Helen, the books of Moses, the Caesars, all started on a morning somewhere east of Baghdad and a handful of seeds, anointed in rows, the earth plowed and well watered. My oats are in. Their bed is firmed over, and now is the time for potatoes. Today I will lay them in rows, rows that cross the field resembling staff lines awaiting their score. I have wondered what a field would sound like, played in a minor key, the notes detailed by the first plants to emerge, a music composed by the field, the sun, and the groping of that resurrection seed. I wonder what a farmer is to wear at this our oldest ritual, this what raised us from being nature's children only a little beyond bears and wolves, those esteemed predators. There really ought to be a sacred robe, a mitered hat for farmers to wear, signifying this holy artifact that is planting. Wasn't this the moment that made words possible? Here commended the Kama Sutra, the Bible, the Tao. From this field rose the temple mound and the pyramid, and an F-18 never flew as was not fueled by a field. For my part, I wear old shoes. Same old shoes I save for rainy days as might ruin a better pair. They look beat up, those shoes. They could use a cobbler. They've been badly used before, but they are comfortable, and I do not think I will ruin them if I spill fertilizer. I also have my flag. My farm has a flag. The design came of Alphonse Mucha, somewhat redacted to my purpose. Queen of the Field, she is called. You might want to keep young children in hand. It is that kind of flag. It is my observation that Christians are lousy at tending the goddess. Never mind, it's the same shape found in the curve of the field. This morning, for one brief moment, I will worship the field the old way. A touch of tobacco, a flag, and my tractor. By the way, named Bucephalus, the same as Alexander. Like Alexander, I have a kingdom to claim, and it begins with planting.
Some writing there from Justin Isherwood, a writer and a farmer in central Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. And if you want to learn some more and hear some more, go to wisconsinlife.org and find them on Facebook as well. So, Melinda, pretty good writer there, isn't he, Justin Isherwood?
Oh, excellent. And just reaches to the heart of what gardening and the earth and being in touch with nature is all about.
Well, we have Leah in Stillwater, Minnesota, with a question for you, and I think this is the perfect time to go to her. Leah, hello.
Hello. That was really fun to listen to.
Thank you.
I have a question about one of the plants of the year, and I can't remember what year, maybe in the 90s, silver feather grass. And it has grown so huge, I would like to reduce its size, and it's got roots that are really difficult to get rid of.
Silver feather, hopefully it's not silver banner, but rather silver feather, which is a clumper, but it does get to be quite a big clump. Really, it's kind of like one of those plants where a good sharp spade, and you may need a hatchet or an axe or someone. I haven't tried this. Someone recommended a drywall saw. I've used a linoleum knife, but I'm going to invest in a drywall saw this year because they said it worked great on those huge clumps that were so hard to cut through. You know, linoleum knife's good and sharp, but it's, you know, for smaller clumps. So, you know, digging out further, getting underneath, maybe getting somebody who wants a chunk of that to take a piece with them so that they help you dig it out. The other thing I wanted to mention, after a hard winter like this year, sometimes the miscanthus, they'll send up a few sprouts out of this big clump and the rest is dead. And if yours isn't overgrown, like Leah's is, you can just take a good sharp spade. Again, make sure it's sharp. Cut through the roots, do a cross hatch so you go through the crown of the plant into the roots. It seems to stimulate it so you get more growth and it'll look full and great the next year. We'll fill in a little bit this season, but definitely next year. So it's kind of a way of stimulating root growth without digging and dividing. In your case, it sounds like you need to dig, divide, and move it. Silver banner grass is Miscanthus sacroflorus that spreads by rhizomes, and it can just take over an area, and it'd be one worth getting rid of. But silver feather is a tall one, clumper, but it can get to be a good-sized clump. So I think you might need some good, strong hands and a sharp spade and
patient
on that one.
Thanks, Leah.
Oh, thank you so much.
Appreciate the call. Larry and Alma, your turn. Hi, Larry.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I live on a farm outside of Elma, and that I really enjoyed Mr. Isherwood's reading.
Yeah, thank you.
Being on a farm and growing up on a farm. We have an old farm that we live on, and not too far from our old farmhouse is an area that at one time was part of the farmstead. There's a couple old limestone foundations. And then over the years, over the last century and a half, trees have grown up in there, and there's little trees and big trees, and we want to thin it out. And there's lots of weed trees, and when I try to cut some down and thin them out, such as the box elder and locust and prickly ash, they spring back up again the next year and sprout out, and then I got 20 of them instead of one. And I'm trying to figure out a way to easily, it's a big area that I want to clean out, make sort of a wooded park. near our house. I'd like to ask Melinda if she has a way to kill these trees. I have bought some Tordon. I've used Roundup in various places, and I use a Tordon successfully in other parts of the farm where I want to kill trees. I'm not worried about the adjoining trees. But here, we have apple trees from the old farmstead. We have pine trees and cherry and other things we want to save, and I'm concerned about any poison spreading to these trees we want to save. Is there a way I can keep these down?
Yeah, cutting them off and then treating the stump is a good way to do that, using something like a Roundup or a stump killer, according to the directions. And then you're putting it right where it's needed. So that's one way to cut it down, treat the stump. It may take several applications just because, you know, with a plant that's been there, it's got an extensive root system. I've even done that where I've cut it down, treated the stump. If it resprouts, wiping the Roundup or my, you know, Roundup on the leaves when they're small, so it's really contained, and then just it may take you all season to get rid of them. You'll still have the root system, but it'll slowly decompose over time. So that's one way to manage it, so that you're cutting down the plant, applying it to the stump, as opposed to spraying larger plants and damaging those nearby plants. The good part about the Roundup is it's taken into the root system. Those plants typically aren't doing root grafts with non-related plants. So if you were concerned about it taking up and going in and spreading by roots, that's usually not an issue going from the locust or the prickly ash into your crab apple.
I was concerned about that.
Right. So the replanting is going to take a while just for those stumps to die out and the root system to disintegrate over time, but then spreading mulch in the area or whatever till you can plant, and that'll take care of it. But the Roundup is pretty specific. Check the label. It's usually like a 50% mix that you use, and then you can just paint it onto that stump and absorb that way.
Okay.
All right. Good luck. Thank you.
Good luck with it.
Facebook question from Jim, who has a 12-year-old apple tree that has always been healthy but no sign of fruit. So this is my first full year of retirement living up north, even with 10 inches of snow, and I read about beating the tree. Oh. Didn't have any buds before the snow hit, so that may be an advantage as we head into the season without snow. And he also loves the show and learns a lot every time.
Well, don't beat your tree.
I've heard people taking a baseball bat to it.
Right, and I've heard rubber hoses and things like that. The idea is to disrupt the flow so that you get a better carbon-nitrogen ratio and you get flowers and fruit. But you can also do a lot of damage if you do it wrong, like kill your tree. And I just have visions, and you probably do too, of somebody out there whacking their tree with a baseball bat. Your neighbors might call the police on you. The better thing to do is, here's a couple things. Fruit trees need good, bright sunlight to flower and fruit. Proper pruning will open it up so you get better light penetration. Last year, that late frost, especially in northern Wisconsin, you know, a lot of orchards lost all, if not most, of their fruit crop because the frost killed the flower buds. Fruit trees need to reach a certain level of maturity to form fruit. Peaches are usually like 3 years. Dwarf apples are like 5 or so, and 7 if they're a large-scale apple tree. So it is time for them. It takes them to reach maturity, the right growing conditions. Avoid high-nitrogen fertilizer that can stimulate leaf and stem growth. So benign neglect is good.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, I am a fan of Milorganite, as probably everybody knows, but the reason I like it is when the microorganisms work on releasing those low levels of nitrogen, it also releases some of the phosphorus and potassium bound in our soil, and we have plenty of it. So that phosphorus is good for flowering and fruiting, potassium good for hardiness and disease resistance. But make sure you need to add anything before you fertilize, because that can also lead to lots of leaves and stems. So check the pruning, watch the weather, you know, kind of review how long ago you planted it, and those kind of things, adjusting that usually will help. And you do need at least a pollinator for many of the trees, apples, some pears, they all produce better with a pollinator. So you need at least two, either crab apple and apple, blooming at the same time to get pollination fertilization in fruit. So look around, too, and make sure that if needed for the fruit trees you're growing, that you are going to get a pollinator so you can get fruit set.
There we go. Roy in Oconomowoc. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Well, we got some dogs there.
Yes, I got my dog doorbells here. They just I just had some friend come in, and they were all upset. But at least I know when there's somebody at the door.
That's true. Okay. Very effective doorbell.
Very effective, yeah. And
what can we do for you?
Okay, I save coffee grounds, and mm-hmm. I use them sort of for a border around the area. But I'm just wondering, what other uses are coffee grounds, or am I just out of my mind, that's all?
No, you're not. And, you know, if you go to certain coffee shops, a lot of them will be glad to share their coffee grounds with people visiting. Coffee grounds are organic matter, so they're great in compost piles. Some people will use them as mulch around their plants, and then, you know, the earthworms and ground beetles and things help take them down into the soil, so they improve the soil. There are a few plants that have that coffee tends to be allelopathic, meaning it's somewhat toxic to, but you have to get pretty high quantities to see that. So spreading it over your soil surface, throwing it in your compost pile. If you do worm composting, the worms love the filters as well as the coffee grounds. So they're great organic matter, and it's excellent for improving your soil. So if you have heavy clay, it improves drainage. If you have gravelly sandy, it improves the water-holding ability. So you're not crazy. It's an excellent resource as well.
We have, thank you again, Roy, for calling. We have Steve in West Allis next. Steve, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Hope you're all doing well. Great show. After decades of gardening, I decided to make things interesting, and I've started entering competitive contests. I've entered the state fair and also the Milwaukee County Fair, and I haven't done very well. I haven't ever heard Melinda talk about fairs and competitive gardening. Just wondering what your opinion is and if you have any advice.
You know, that's a great question. I used to, when I was an extension agent, I used to judge 4-H fairs. We kind of had to do it because I hated, like, when I wanted to give every kid a blue ribbon.
Sure.
You know, it was like, it always rained the night before and their petunias would be battered or the rabbit just ate their lettuce. And I was like, oh. So, you know, here's a couple of things. Grow more than you need so that you have a lot to choose from. Consistency in size is always good. And then picking your best quality. And then reading the entries very closely, because there's usually a lot of clues that tell you what they're looking for. And, you know, if it's three of something, you want those three to be pretty uniform in shape, blemish-free, exhibiting good quality. So checking that out. Cleaning them appropriately, you know, instead of, you know, digging them out of the garden and putting them on a plate. I'm sure you have done that, Steve, yeah. But, you yeah. know, sometimes it gets to be crazy and it always yeah. seems to rain. Did the judges give you any comments back?
They did give some feedback, but, like, one of the problems I had is the Milwaukee County Fair is the last weekend in September, and, like, tomatoes, it's tough getting them to last that long. I mean, are there any
yes.
good varieties or any? I don't know where to go to for the info to get stuff that's going to last way into September for that judging.
Yeah, one of the things you want to do is look for indeterminate tomatoes. If you're going to enter tomatoes, indeterminates grow and they produce flowers and fruits until the frost kills them. So that's going to give you the longest productivity and hopefully the best selection. You might want to also try using things like floating row covers sold as Remay or Harvest Guard to keep insects off when you don't need them for pollination. You know, obviously you need pollination to get squash and melons, but once they're formed, you know, covering the plants might help. Cabbage for cabbage worm and things like that. So if you don't want to use chemicals, you know, covering them to physically keep those insects off, especially those plants you don't need the pollination. And ripeness, you're right. It's always hard to get it at that right timing. And that's, again, where the floating row covers can help warm things up if you need to speed up, or a late planting if there are some things. And I haven't looked at the Milwaukee County entry forms for a long time. But if you had broccoli or cauliflower things, you know, a summer planting for a fall harvest. The same with cucumbers. You could do a summer planting for a fall harvest so that you can extend your garden season. Good for the dinner table. Might help you in terms of winning some of those blue ribbons as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a great point. Dennis Lukaszewski, I'm going to name him by name, manages that, does a great job. And, you know, maybe give him a nudge and I'll do the same. And maybe we need to get some good information. Extension used to have some good things out there for 4-H'ers. And I'm not sure those publications are still out and about. But you might want to see because they had good publications on tips and hints. But you're right. You need to try to pick vegetables, guess how the season's going to go so that you get peak maturity just before through just after, so hopefully you'll get three good ones if that's what you have to enter.
There we go. And that they might be available. I just go to the Learning Store and check out whether or not those publications are available. They might be. They might still be there.
I think they might be. Yeah. 4-H does some great things, and we don't always think about them, especially in urban areas. And I just want to put a plug in for those people that are in the southeast Wisconsin area. I'll be out and about answering questions tomorrow and talking more about repairing your landscape after last year's drought and this spring's flooding at the Stein Gardens and Gifts on South 27th from 11 to 1 and the Waukesha store from 2 to 4. So if we didn't get your question answered this morning or this afternoon, I'll be glad to help you tomorrow.
Okay, so again, that's at the Steins, is it?
Stein Gardens and Gifts, Science Garden Center on South 27th from 11 to 1 on Saturday the 4th and from 2 to 4 in the Waukesha store on Moreland Road, so Moreland Boulevard. I always get those two mixed up, but the one in Waukesha.
Melinda, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Larry. You have a great day, and good luck to all those folks. Snow's a good mulch and insulator. Just hold that thought as you're looking at that snow on top of your bulbs up north.
Right. Melinda Myers, our guest. Oh, she'll be back. Always a great pleasure to have her with us, and she'll be back. Go to our website, melindamyers.com. We have it up on my Facebook page. You can get a copy or click onto it right from my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Just a reminder, too, we're teaming up with the Natural Resources Foundation to do a birding trip at Picnic Point in Madison. Judith and I will be going, and Andy Palios will lead the outing. He's the coordinator of the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative. He's also a biologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And it's going to be actually on Mother's Day, Sunday, May 12th, from 8:30 in the morning till 11:30. So 3 hours we'll be tramping around out on Picnic Point. We have room for 20 people to join us. So we'll be picking 10 listeners. Not going to cost anything. It's just a little competition here. We'll pick 10 listeners, and each listener can then bring a guest. And to enter, you just need to send an email to talk@wpr.org. Send an email to talk@wpr.org with bird trip as the subject. So put in the subject line bird trip and send that email by 5 o'clock Sunday. And we'll let everybody know on Monday if they've won. And they'll need to confirm by Tuesday morning to secure their spot. So be sure to be checking your email. That's going to be a lot of fun. Again, the birding outing with Judith and I are doing with the Natural Resources Foundation on Sunday, May 12th from 8:30 to 11:30, Picnic Point in Madison. This is a great place with thousands of birds. To enter, go to talk@wpr.org with bird trip as the subject. And thank you all for listening. And please stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.